Hello out there in cyberspace. Stories of the death of religion in America are overblown. If you're in the right part of the country, there are vibrant Christian communities developing apps, working in Christian startups, and spreading their faith on Instagram and YouTube. There is a whole community and culture just outside of the mainstream using tech in all sorts of wild and interesting ways. With us today to explore the weird world of evangelical tech is Karina Laughlin. She is a professor of media studies at Loyola Marymount University and the author of the excellent book, Redeem All, How Digital Life is Changing Evangelical Culture. The author of the book, Redeem All, How Digital Life is Changing Evangelical Culture. I'm Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I'd love to get basic stuff out of the way first. So can you define, for those who may not know, there's a bunch of different sects and types of Christians. What do we mean when we say evangelical?
Well, evangelicals are conservative Protestant Christians. They've often been defined by sort of their emphasis on their literal belief in the Bible as the Word of God, centrality of Jesus, being born again, and a sort of emphasis on activism and sort of getting their faith out there and trying to proselytize and things like that. There's a lot of different denominations that, you know, sort of are evangelical in some cases and not in others. So it's somewhat of a messy, big tent. But in general, conservative Christian Protestants is what we're talking about when we talk about evangelicals.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of the stereotypical, maybe if you've lived in the South or the Southwest, it's kind of the stereotypical idea of a Christian, I think.
Yeah, and there's a lot of media representations of evangelicals. You know, I think in some ways they sometimes get like a bad rap or in the media as being, you know, particularly sort of churchy, Jesus-y or something like that. But yes, mega churches tend to be evangelicals, and they also have a really robust media footprint and kind of culture, right? You know, contemporary Christian music, bumper stickers, billboards. It's evangelicalism is everywhere in American culture.
And they're also very tech savvy, right? Which is kind
Absolutely.
Of what your book's about.
Right. Yeah. I mean, relative, especially to other religious traditions, evangelicals, even historically, have been early adopters of especially consumer media technologies. And they've kind of created a parallel popular culture in a lot of cases, you know, all the way going back to, for example, radio, the first mass medium in the United States, we could argue. They were, you know, creating evangelical radio shows, television, of course, famously or infamously. We had televangelists and televangelism becoming really popular and even though it suffered a lot of scandals, remains really popular for a certain subset of people. So it's no surprise that they've also been early adopters of technology and created their own, you know, apps and technological products to serve churches and to serve an evangelical audience.
Just a small anecdote about like what this can look like in the real world. I'm from Dallas, where there are a lot of mega churches, and there's a lot of political power behind like the evangelical churches there. It was not uncommon. It happened to me a couple times where it's like you happen to see a coffee shop that's an independent place. You're like, oh, that's not Starbucks. I'll go check that out. You go in and you take your order. You're sitting down, you're reading a book or what have you. And then 10, 15 minutes later, somebody comes up and starts proselytizing to you. Mm-hmm. And maybe tries to get you to sign up for an app. And it turned out that this place is a front group, well, that maybe is more sinister than it sounds, but it's like the whole reason the coffee shop exists is to draw parishioners in to these church services, right?
We actually have several here in LA too. Really? I don't think that. Yeah, there's one right on Venice Boulevard. I drive by it all the time, a coffee shop called Coffee Connection that's run by a church. There's one in Santa Monica. So it's a pretty common strategy, and it's kind of the same thing. This trying to be sort of what they call in but not of the world, right? Like, we want to be out there. We want to be attracting people with the things they like, whether it's a coffee shop or an app. But we can't be of the world, meaning we can't be taken in by sort of the darker side of popular culture, what they would consider the darker side.
All right. So walk me through Christian startup culture. Like, what does it look like? What does it mean to develop an app for evangelicals?
I think the most interesting thing to me when I started looking into Christian startup culture in Silicon Valley, I spent some time, you know, actually in the San Francisco area, but also in places like Dallas and Nashville and other places where people are creating apps geared toward a Christian audience. The most interesting thing to me was that Christians were really attracted to this idea coming out of Silicon culture that consumer media technologies could positively change the world, right? So, or put a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs, said. So they were really attracted by this idea that if consumer media technologies can change the world for the better, which was sort of a big part of Silicon Valley sloganeering, especially around 10 years ago, then Christians using that technology could help to make culture more Christian, or could even, you know, in some cases I heard them say, you know, help them, you know, evangelize to the world and maybe even hasten the return of Christ, right? Like, actually fulfill biblical prophecies as well. Now, not all of them put their mission in such stark terms, but this idea coming out of Silicon Valley was incredibly attractive to a lot of evangelicals who then decided to create their own apps, their own technological products, with the hope, you know, to varying degrees, that they would, make a dent in popular culture and help people become better Christians or become Christians.
So what do those apps look like? Like, what does an app look like that is trying to hasten the return of Jesus Christ?
I mean, there are so many different evangelical apps. I think there's apps that are geared towards churches. So tithing apps have become incredibly common. Just sort of when you go into an evangelical church, it's pretty normal to just be sort of directed to an app to tithe. So there's all sorts of apps that are sort of at that level and just sort of serve Christian communities in that way. But then there's other apps, for example, like YouVersion, the Bible app, which was created by a church in Oklahoma, Life Church, which its mission is more sort of theologically broad, and it's trying to get the Bible to every person on earth, translated into every language, even languages that are spoken only by, a couple thousand people or even a couple hundred people, in fulfillment of a biblical prophecy that once the Bible is brought to every tribe and tongue, that Jesus can return.
All right, I have to ask, because anybody I've told that we're having this conversation brings up this one specific app. I think even when I reached out to you for the initial interview, we were like, "Oh, you want to talk about the porn app?"
Oh, okay, yeah.
What's the deal with the evangelical porn app?
Well, porn is seen as a great evil in evangelical culture that can tear apart families, that can sort of lead people away from faith. And it's just everywhere, right? As we all know, porn is very accessible, right? And so it's seen as a huge problem within evangelical culture. And there's been a whole suite of technological solutions. There's a few different apps that are geared towards accountability. So what they do is you sign up for this app, and then the app shares your browser history with an accountability buddy every month. And so you keep that person accountable for not looking at porn, and they keep you accountable for not looking at porn. I think there's a couple of those. One that I know about is Covenant Eyes. There's another app that just uses AI and detects any sort of like nudity. So it's not just about porn, but it's like if you're looking at Twitter, it can, or it purports to be able to block any sort of nudity on the internet that you might encounter to just sort of completely keep you away from porn. And then there's Google Chrome extensions that are just about, you know, blocking porn. I think maybe the most interesting one is also a ministry, and that's Triple X Church. It's an app. They also do the accountability thing. And I think they have a, like you can call or email with people if you're suffering from porn addiction, and they have a sort of plan to get people out of porn addiction. But they also go to, you know, like adult film conventions, porn conventions, and they proselytize to, you know, people working in the adult film industry. And the woman running it now is a former adult film star, and she's now a pastor in San Diego, and she runs this app and this ministry. So there's been a lot of innovation in the evangelical sphere around trying to help people stay away from internet porn, right? Trying to help people stay away from the dark side of the internet. Because as much as evangelicals want to be out there and want to be sort of on the internet and attracting people using these technological tools, they definitely see that as a dark side of the internet.
Yeah, it was kind of fascinating reading the book. How much energy is geared towards putting those guardrails up? Right, making sure that the more worldly parts of the internet don't interfere with the world that they're building. Right? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I really like the way that you put that. I think that's absolutely true. And I think in general, that's something you could also see outside of evangelical culture with sort of moral panics around like what children can and can't access online. But, you know, it's just sort of trying to keep the world out while still trying to be in the world. So it kind of goes back to that, you know, sort of a central directive of evangelical activism in the world, being out there, attracting people, you know, having your coffee shop, right? But also staying true to, you know, your faith.
There's so many interesting connections you make in the book. Can you take us through the through line of how a mega church becomes a startup church?
Yeah. So mega churches, I'm sure a lot of people who are listening in the United States or watching in the United States are familiar with these because they're all over the country. This trend kind of started in the 1970s with the church growth movement. A few evangelicals who started looking at the American suburbs and saying, wow, here is a population of people who, you know, have moved out to the suburbs. They're, you know, somewhat modern. They are really into these strip malls with big box stores. Let's build a church targeted towards them that they're going to like, right? Towards what they called the spiritual seeker. And so that's when these churches started to pop up that actually look like, you know, and by design look like, you know, TJ Maxx's or Olive Garden's, right? Or are next to a TJ Maxx or an Olive Garden, right? I think
restaurants and stores in them sometimes too, right?
Often, yeah, have big campuses with all sorts of stuff you can do, and going back again, the coffee shop and stuff for the kids and childcare and all this stuff to make it attractive for this specific type of person, this suburbanite, right? These churches were incredibly successful. This strategy was really successful. And churches kind of grew and grew and grew to the point where You know, if you were a particularly charismatic pastor, sort of pastoring one of these mega churches, you know, you might be speaking in a stadium, right? Like Joel Osteen or any other, you know, sort of person you could point to. And so media kind of became necessary, right? And these mega churches kind of became multi-site. So one church would have like four different sites, and they did it in different ways, where either the pastor would be simulcast into a different smaller church where people could kind of go, almost like an overflow church that then became its own church, or there would be like a sort of a church brand. And the logic of branding, the logic of marketing coming directly from the corporate world influences what these churches look like, how they think about themselves. They're directly taking cues from, Target, from In-N-Out, from Costco, from these places where they see, Americans going and enjoying and, you know, sort of participating in, right? With the sort of advent of the startup and startup culture, and another sort of really popular cultural form emerging, came this idea of the church maybe functioning more like a startup as well. I went to Life Church, which is the most technological. Advanced church.
Is it Life Church or Life.Church?
I think it's Life Church. They used to be LifeChurch.tv, okay. And then they changed it. It's a good question. I think they're just sort of, you don't say the dot. I don't think I've ever heard it, but I might be wrong about that.
I just think maybe it's just my internet poisoned brain. Because in the book it's written Life.Church. So I always said it in my head as I was reading Life.Church. I think it just evokes this startup culture, basically. But yeah, please, a pretty large portion of the book devoted to kind of like Life.Church as a case study. And I'm very interested to hear you talk about it.
Well, I think what you're saying is like, it's no accident, right? It's supposed to be kind of like a digital church in the real world. In some ways, right? So Life Church was a mega church. It's a really successful church. It's also a multi-site church. But at their main site in Edmond, Oklahoma, they actually have, they run YouVersion, which is a really mega popular. It's kind of the killer app in evangelicalism. It's been downloaded 500 million times all around the world. It's used across like sort of evangelical influencer and media culture. It's just really popular. And they started it right there at the church. They spent $20 million. It was reported by the New York Times that they spent $20 million in just 2013 alone, attracting people from all over the country, developers, engineers, right? People who were working at startups, to come to their church in Oklahoma, and create technology. They've created not only YouVersion, they also have, Open, which is, where they create resources for churches. They created a church online platform that I was told by, and they give this stuff away all freely, right? I was told by, some people, and I can't verify this, that for-profit or even not-for-profit other church online platforms went out of business because of the popularity of Life Church's church online platform. And when you go there, you know, they have futurists, they have, engineers. It looks really very similar to, secular tech startups that you would find in Silicon Valley.
All right, we're going to pause there for a break so I can create an ad break for the podcast version of the show. If you're watching on Twitch, we will be starting right back up immediately. If you're listening to the show on afterwards as a podcast, please listen to these lovely ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, that's enough silence for me to properly put it in after when I'm editing this later. Thank you for sticking around Twitch stream. Here's a good question from the chat. Emily, I see that question. I'm going to put a pin in it, though, because I do want to kind of dovetail off of what you were just talking about. And you mentioned this at the top, but there is this compatibility between evangelical culture and like what I would call Silicon Valley ideology. Can you talk about that a little bit more? They kind of work very well together, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I think, as I kind of alluded to before, the ideal, that sort of like ideal figure of the social entrepreneur, you know, it used to be that you couldn't just make an app. It had to be doing something good, you know, or if it was making a lot of money here, then it should be giving like an equal amount of money to people in Africa, or, you know, it had to be doing something good, right? And that was a big part of Silicon Valley culture, this sense, and that was internalized and self-reflexive, that any consumer media technology had to be saving the world or doing something good, positive, right? I think a lot of that veil has been lifted over the past few years, and it's now okay to just be just a for-profit machine, right? But that idea was, you know, is really appealing to evangelicals, right? And there's a venture capital firm called Praxis that I talk a little bit about in the book. And they fund businesses based on this idea of what they call redemptive entrepreneurship. And I really saw this theme coming across in my conversations and my ethnographic work with evangelical tech founders, this idea that, you know, any entrepreneurship should also have, you know, the goal of redeeming something, right? Whether it's, for example, helping people stay away from internet porn, or whether it's just, we're going to run a business with Christian values, and people are going to see that and be influenced by the way we're running a business. So sort of running the gamut from like, we're actually going to redeem the world in this sort of theological way, to we're just going to bring Christian values into the tech world, and thereby, you know, just by a presence, make things better. But that was sort of a goal that undergirded a lot of these projects that in what people called, and what I called in my book, the faith tech sector.
Question from chat. So how did COVID-19 affect all of this?
Well, COVID-19 forced those churches that were maybe wary of all these technological tools to adopt them, right? You know, people had to go online, and churches had to go online. There's even mainline churches, right? When we think of evangelicals, we think of them as being much more technologically savvy, whereas mainline churches might be a little bit more hesitant in general. There's a Lutheran church that I live nearby, and they started hosting online services, right? So I think all the work that evangelicals had done, you know, from 2000, let's say 2006, which when there was Life Church started the first online church, to 2020, when churches were forced to go online, all the work and all the infrastructure that evangelicals had laid down during that time, all of a sudden became incredibly useful, you know, just like in, you know, education and teaching, like all these sort of, like how Zoom became super popular all of a sudden, or the other apps, the same thing happened in evangelical culture. And, you know, they already had all these tools ready for COVID-19, for the sort of, you know, conditions that COVID-19 caused, everybody having to stay home.
Wow. Emily in chat is as if she's following my guide that I wrote, because her next question is my next question as well. And that is, so there's this, part of this world is not just the apps, it's also the influencers. It's mm-hmm. people on TikTok and YouTube that are making videos trying to draw people in. There's a whole evangelical influencer culture, right? And I think we come across those things in the mainstream when they're being mocked, I think. That's mm-hmm. when we tend to see them. But there is – it's a huge audience, right? Can you talk a little bit about what that work is like for them and kind of what their goals are and what their TikTok looks like versus mainstream TikTok?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I'm working on a project now about Christian TikTok. But what I wrote about a lot in the book was about especially women on Instagram. There are a lot of influencers on Instagram who are kind of what you might expect. They look like and they post pictures like what you might expect from an evangelical woman, the sort of like trad wife, right? Sort of like traditional femininity on display and expressed. You know, there's a lot of Christian mommy bloggers who then became like sort of mommy influencers. So there's a lot of that. And I call their sort of expression of femininity, popular parochial feminism, because it sort of latches on to some of the semiotics of evangelical culture, and especially its parochialism, and its sort of traditional belief in male headship, or the way that you know, men should sort of be the leaders of the family and women should sort of be in charge of the children and the home, right? Sort of these traditional domestic spheres with God ruling over all of it. So while they express that on Instagram, what I found really interesting when I was doing research on them was that they also expressed a lot of feminist beliefs to the point where you know, some of them, people like Jen Hatmaker, who's incredibly popular, you know, she has this amazing super popular podcast. She's popular on Instagram. She's popular across all sorts of media. But she's come out against a lot of the conservative evangelical stances, especially on LGBT marriage. She's come out against transphobia and homophobia in evangelical culture. And she's like hated by some people and loved by others. So I think a lot of these influencers who are women are really sort of pushing conversations that wouldn't have been had they not had access to these platforms where they're able to express a more modern view of, you know, especially gender relations in evangelical culture.
Another place this is happening that you talk about in the book is conversations about race in Black mm-hmm. churches, mostly happening in podcasts, right?
Well, I looked at it in a podcast. I'm sure that's not the only place that it's happening. I mean, there's, you know, books, there's several really popular podcasts run by Black Christians. And when I was talking to them in, you know, 2020 and 2021, they were really trying to push the evangelical church, which is, you know, it isn't like Catholicism where there's a pope or there's some central authority, but there are, you know, sort of multiple centers of authority, like Bible colleges, like, you know, the National Association of Evangelicals, like all these big nonprofits and even big media empires like Lifeway Christian Resources, which is run by the Southern Baptist Convention. A lot of those organizations and power structures in evangelicalism are run by white evangelicals, right? And there's a lot of, you know, great writing about how a lot of evangelical culture has been defined by whiteness, right? And Jamar Tisby wrote a book called The Color of Compromise, going all the way back to, you know, slavery and sort of the evangelical response to slavery. Anthea Butler wrote about this idea of evangelical gentility, right? Maybe they won't talk about race, but they're also going to punish like a Black Christian who decides to talk about race as being divisive, right? So all these podcasters, you know, during the time of like, you know, the uprisings in 2020, started talking about pushing back against some of this evangelical gentility, this sense that, you know, talking about race was sort of wrong or divisive. And they tried to open up more conversations about race. And again, it's another sort of like division point or fissure in evangelical culture that has always been there. But I think because these Black Christians now have access to this really powerful media, it's a lot more prominent than it might be. Like, it can't be, you know, sort of swept under the rug in the same way.
Yeah, I think from the outside, people look at American Protestant Christianity specifically as a monoculture.
Right.
And it's not. It's like you said, there's all sorts of fissures and divisions and all sorts of arguments about, you know, everything from liturgy to exactly how to set up your church, right? There's all sorts of arguments and conversations. And like which televangelist is in trouble and which one is righteous, etc. Right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, whenever we often hear about evangelicals in relation to politics, right? That evangelicals have been seen as like, you know, the Republican Party at prayer. But to do that, to make that distinction, pollsters poll white evangelicals, right? So there are evangelicals of there's vibrant cultures and sites of evangelicalism that are non-white. There's the tradition of the Black church, a lot of that, which intersects with evangelical culture, right? So, you know, it's always kind of a fiction to think of evangelicalism that way, even though it's useful for understanding political participation, right? Because 80% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. Well, that's a really powerful statistic. It's a really big number. And it gives us a sense of what white evangelical culture looks like. But evangelicalism is not just white, and it never has been.
So all this, you know, there's this narrative that I kind of checked up at the top of the show that religion is in decline in America, fewer people going to church, et cetera, et cetera. But I think if you look at these mega churches, you know, and where in the places where I used to live and look at the parking lots on Sunday, it doesn't feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Do you think all of this adoption of technology, this rush to develop apps and kind of meet people where they live, I guess, is it any of it having an effect? Are some of these churches growing?
It's really hard to say. I think when you look at the statistics, you know, the growth of the millennial nuns is a real thing. So people, you know, under 40 have been moving away from organized religion and especially been moving away from evangelicalism. You know, and there's sort of some hard numbers and hard data on this. That being said, right, I mean, this is something that's well known within evangelical culture, and it's part of the reason that they're trying to reach out via these technological tools that they see as really popular among these people, right? So they're trying to say, hey, we're hip, we're cool, we can still be part of the conversation, right? And that's their strategy. Is it working? It's very, very hard to say. You know, it's a very hard thing, I think, to measure. My belief is that it isn't working in the way that they wanted it to work, right? And there's because of a lot of this growth of you know, division, there's also a big growth of the ex-evangelical movement, right? The evangelicals who used to be or evangelicals who have left the faith, right? And there's a big podcast devoted to that. You know, all sorts of social media campaigns that are related to that. There's been the growth of like the Me Too movement in evangelical culture. So all of this, you know, sort of opening up of division and debate that has come along with the move to modernize evangelical culture by making it more digital, by integrating digital technologies, has had, unintended effects, I think.
Yeah. Every culture war you choose to fight hardens the faithful, but also pushes some folks out. right?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true.
How do you think, has the internet and all this technology changed the faith at all? How, like, you can't just, you're affected by your tools too, mm-hmm. right? It's a two-way street. It's not something you can just pick up and use to change the world in your own image. It also is changing you as you use it. How do you think that all this tech is changing evangelicals?
I think there's a lot of ways, and I think we've kind of touched on some of them, the way that people who would not have been able to have spoken before, women who would not be able to preach, right, all of a sudden have these sort of congregations on Instagram, right? That's just one example, right? So the sort of more voices and opening up more voices has changed evangelical culture in that way, right? I also think there's, looking at it a different way, like different understanding of scope, right? So an understanding of reach and potentially global scope that, a church like Life Church has, right? They have an online church that attracts people from all over the world. So that changes the kind of messages that they put out there, right? If you're speaking not to a local community, but to what you see or what you imagine to be a global community, you have a different understanding of your own mission. And so I think that the tools allow for that sort of change in the evangelical imagination, which has been influential, I think, in terms of how evangelicals have kind of moved forward.
All right. So to close this out, can you tell us a little bit more about your book? What else is in there that we haven't touched on? Where can people find it?
This is it. I have one right here.
Beautiful.
It's kind of got a glare on it. Redeem All, How Evangelical Life is Changing How Digital Life is Changing Evangelical Culture. I should know the title. And it's from the University of California Press. I think you can get it anywhere. I don't know. I've never tried to get it because they just sent them to me. Actually, I think if you Google it, you can get it.
I've got a good question from I was playing the outro music, but I'm going to stop it because I just got a good question from chat.
Okay, cool.
I'd like to see how this would affect communities in rural America. What did you kind of see looking at that? Because it is very, like, suburban megachurch is very different from rural churches.
Mm-hmm.
Did you look at that at all? Did you have any experience with that?
I would say my experience with that was somewhat minimal. Most of the churches that I spent time in and talked to had pretty large congregations. I know there's a lot of rural churches that have lost members and don't have the resources of some of these churches. Life Church, I would say, that infrastructure that they've created is pretty vast, and they give all this stuff away for free, so it can be used all over, all across by anyone running a church.
Is it then kind of like what's happened in the rest of America, where these large mega churches have kind of drained parishioners and people from these, you're seeing the closing down of Main Street America, but Main Street Church, right? Mm-hmm. And then to replace it, people get, if they can't move into the suburbs or the cities, they're getting apps that kind of fill in those blanks. I mean, I know that's, we're just kind of speculating here, right? But it sounds very similar.
I mean, I do think that's a fear that I heard people talk about. Like, they don't want to, when people are planting a church or starting up a church, that's something that's talked about, right? Are we just stealing parishioners, like, from other places? And it certainly could be the case. I didn't, like, see evidence that was happening. Right. But it is a fear. I know that I've heard people talk about that, they don't want to just, like, sort of replace local churches. I do think the mega churches have done that. Right. Yeah. In a lot of ways. Right. And I do think the way that technology has been integrated and diffused and distributed across evangelical culture could be potentially doing the same thing.
Now I'm really going to play the outro music. So in chat, don't ask any more good questions. The book is Redeem All. It's wherever you get books, and it's really good. The author is Karina Laughlin. Thank you so much for coming on to Cyber. If you like the show, like, subscribe, leave us a comment. It helps other people find the show. If you're watching this live on Twitch, you missed the beginning of it. It'll be available as a VOD quite shortly, and then as a podcast in an hour or so, as soon as I can get it up. I'm pretty hungry. I'm going to go eat lunch. But, you know, we will be back again next week with two more conversations about cyber and technology. I've already recorded one of them. It's about using open source intelligence to help people escape Ukraine. It's a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy it. We will be back then. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. Thank you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.